to be known among the poor as cringe or starve. The Taoist philosopher Chuang Tzu described such efforts to be egoless as beating a drum in search of a fugitive, or as we would put it, driving to a police raid with sirens on. Or as the Hindus say, it is like trying not to think of a monkey while taking medicine on the basis of the popular superstition that thinking of a monkey will make the medicine ineffective. All that such efforts can teach us is that they do not work, for the more we try to behave without greed or fear, the more we realize that we are doing this for greedy or fearful reasons. Saints have always declared themselves as abject sinners, through recognition that their aspiration to be saintly is motivated by the worst of all sins, spiritual pride, the desire to admire oneself as a supreme success in the art of love and unselfishness. And beneath this lies a bottomless pit of vicious circles. The game, I am more penitent than you, or my pride in my humility is worse than yours. Is there any way not to be involved in some kind of one-upmanship? I am less of a one-upman than you. I am a worse one-upman than you. I realize more clearly than you that everything we do is one-upmanship. The ego trick seems to reaffirm itself endlessly in posture after posture. But as I pursue these games, as I become more conscious of being conscious, more aware that I am unable to define myself as being up without you or something other than myself being down, I see vividly that I depend on your being down for my being up. I would never be able to know that I belong to the in-group of nice or saved people without the assistance of an out-group of nasty or damned people. How can any in-group maintain its collective ego without relishing dinner table discussions about the ghastly conduct of outsiders? The very identity of racist Southerners depends upon contrasting themselves with those dirty black negroes. But conversely, the out-groups feel that they are really and truly in, and nourish their collective ego with relishingly indignant conversation about squares, Ofays, wasps, Philistines, and the blasted bourgeoisie. Even St. Thomas Aquinas let it out that part of the blessedness of the saints in heaven was that they could look over the battlements and enjoy the proper justice of the sinners squirming in hell. All winners need losers. All saints need sinners. All sages need fools. That is, so long as the major kick in life is to amount to something or to be someone as a particular and separate godlet. But I define myself in terms of you. I know myself only in terms of what is other, no matter whether I see the other as below me or above me in any ladder of values. If above, I enjoy the kick of self-pity. If below, I enjoy the kick of pride. I being I goes with you being you. Thus, as a great Hasidic rabbi put it, if I am I because you are you, and if you are you because I am I, then I am not I, and you are not you. Instead, we are both something in common between what Martin Buber has called I and thou and I and it, the magnet itself, which lies between the poles, between I myself and everything sensed as other. There it is, a theoretically undeniable fact. But the question is how to get over the sensation of being locked out from everything other, of being only oneself, an organism flung into unavoidable competition and conflict with almost every object in its experience. There are innumerable recipes for this project, almost all of which have something to recommend them. There are the practices of yoga meditation, dervish dancing, psychotherapy, Zen Buddhism, Ignatian, Salesian, and Hesychast methods of prayer, the use of consciousness-changing chemicals such as LSD and mescaline, psychodrama, group dynamics, sensory awareness techniques, Quakerism, Gurdjieff exercises, relaxation therapies, the Alexander method, autogenic training and self-hypnosis. The difficulty with every one of these disciplines is that the moment you are seriously involved, you find yourself boxed in some special in-group which defines itself, often with the most elegant subtlety, by the exclusion of an out-group. In this way, every religion or cult is self-defeating, and this is equally true of projects which define themselves as non-religions, or universally inclusive religions, playing the game of I am less exclusive than you. It is thus that religions and non-religions all established in the name of brotherhood and universal love, are invariably divisive and quarrelsome. What, for example, is more quarrelsome in practical politics than the project for a truly classless and democratic society? Yet the historical origin of this movement is mystical. It goes back to Jesus and St. Paul, to Eckhart and Tauler, to the Anabaptists, levelers and brothers of the free spirit, and their insistence that all men are equal in the sight of God. It seems almost as if to be is to quarrel, or at least to differ, to be in contrast with something else. If so, whoever does not put up a fight has no identity. Whoever is not selfish has no self. Nothing unites a community so much as common cause against an external enemy. Yet, in the same moment, that enemy becomes the essential support of social unity. Therefore, larger societies require larger enemies, bringing us in due course to the perilous point of our present situation, where the world is virtually divided into two huge camps. But if high officers on both sides have any intelligence at all, they make a secret agreement to contain the conflict, to call each other the worst names, but to refrain from dropping bombs. Or, if they insist that there must be some fighting to keep armies in trim, they restrict it to local conflicts in unimportant countries. Voltaire should have said that if the devil did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him. Nevertheless, the more it becomes clear that to be is to quarrel and to pursue self-interest, the more you are compelled to recognize your need for enemies to support you. In the same way, the more resolutely you plumb the question, who or what am I, the more unavoidable is the realization that you are nothing at all apart from everything else. Yet again, the more you strive for some kind of perfection or mastery in morals, in art, or in spirituality, the more you see that you are playing a rarefied and lofty form of the old ego game, and that your attainment of any height is apparent to yourself and to others only by contrast with someone else's depth or failure. This understanding is at first paralyzing. You are in a trap, in the worst of all, double binds, seeing that any direction you may take will imply, and so evoke, its opposite. Decide to be a Christ, and there will be a Judas to betray you and a mob to crucify you. Decide to be a devil, and men will unite against you in the closest brotherly love. Your first reaction may be simply, to hell with it. The only course may seem to forget the whole effort and become absorbed in trivialities, or to check out of the game by suicide or psychosis and spend the rest of your days blabbering in an asylum. But there is another possibility. Instead of checking out, let us ask what the trap means. What is implied in finding yourself paralyzed, unable to escape from a game in which all the rules are double binds and all moves self-defeating? Surely this is a deep and intense experience of the same double bind that was placed upon you in infancy, when the community told you that you must be free, responsible, and loving, and when you were helplessly defined as an independent agent. The sense of paralysis is therefore the dawning realization that this is nonsense, and that your independent ego is a fiction. It simply isn't there, either to do anything or to be pushed around by external forces, to change things, or to submit to change. The sense of I, which should have been identified with the whole universe of your experience, was instead cut off and isolated as a detached observer of that universe. In the preceding chapter, we saw that this unity of organism and environment is a physical fact. But when you know for sure that your separate ego is a fiction, you actually feel yourself as the whole process and pattern of life. Experience and experiencer become one experiencing, known and knower, one knowing. Each organism experiences this from a different standpoint and in a different way, for each organism is the universe experiencing itself in endless variety. One need not, then, fall into the trap which this experience holds for believers in an external, all-powerful God, the temptation to feel, I am God, in that sense, and to expect to be worshipped and obeyed by all other organisms. Remember, above all, that an experience of this kind cannot be forced or made to happen by any act of your fictitious will, except insofar as repeated efforts to be one up on the universe may eventually reveal their futility. Don't try to get rid of the ego sensation. Take it, so long as it lasts, as a feature or play of the total process, like a cloud or wave, or like feeling warm or cold, or anything else that happens of itself. Getting rid of one's ego is the last resort of invincible egoism. It simply confirms and strengthens the reality of the feeling. But when this feeling of separateness is approached and accepted like any other sensation, it evaporates like the mirage that it is. This is why I am not overly enthusiastic about the various spiritual exercises in meditation or yoga, which some consider essential for release from the ego. For when practiced in order to get some kind of spiritual illumination or awakening, they strengthen the fallacy that the ego can toss itself away by a tug at its own bootstraps. But there is nothing wrong with meditating just to meditate, in the same way that you listen to music just for the music. If you go to concerts to get culture or to improve your mind, you will sit there as deaf as a doorpost. If, then, you ask me how to get beyond the ego feeling, I shall ask you why you want to get there. If you give me the honest answer, which is that your ego will feel better in the higher spiritual status of self-transcendence, you will thus realize that you, as ego, are a fake. You will feel like an onion, skin after skin, subterfuge after subterfuge, is pulled off to find no kernel at the center, which is the whole point, to find out that the ego is indeed a fake. A wall of defense around a wall of defense, around nothing. You can't even want to get rid of it, nor yet want to. Understanding this, you will see that the ego is exactly what it pretends it isn't. Far from being the free center of personality, it is an automatic mechanism implanted since childhood by social authority, with, perhaps, a touch of heredity thrown in. This may give you the temporary feeling of being a zombie or a puppet dancing irresponsibly on strings that lead away to unknown forces. At this point, the ego may reassert itself with the insidious "I can't help myself" play, in which the ego splits itself in two and pretends that it is its own victim. See, I'm only a bundle of conditioned reflexes, so you mustn't get angry with me for acting just as I feel. To which the answer could be, well, we're just zombies too, so you shouldn't complain if we get angry. But who is it that mustn't get angry or shouldn't complain, as if there were still some choice in the matter? The ego is still surviving as the I, which must passively endure the automatic behavior of myself and others. Again, as if there were some choice which the witnessing self can make between putting up with things and attacking them violently. What has happened is that the frustrated ego has withdrawn into its last stronghold of independence, retaining its identity as a mere watcher or sufferer of all that goes on. Here it pities itself or consoles itself as a puppet of fate. But if this is seen as yet another subterfuge, we are close to the final showdown. A line of separation is now drawn between everything that happens to me, including my own feelings, on the one side, and on the other, I myself as the conscious witness. Isn't it easy to see that this line is imaginary, and that it, and the witness behind it, are the same old faking process automatically learned in childhood? The same old cleft between the knower and the known. The same old split between the organism/environment and the organism's feedback, or self-conscious mechanism. If, then, there is no choice in what happens to me on one side of the line, there is equally no choice on the other, on the witnessing side, as to whether I should accept what happens or reject it. I accept, I reject, I witness just as automatically as things happen or as my emotions reflect my physiological chemistry. Yet in this moment, when one seems about to become a really total zombie, the whole thing blows up. For there is no fate unless there is someone or something to be fated. There is no trap without someone to be caught. There is indeed no compulsion unless there is also freedom of choice. For the sensation of behaving involuntarily is known only by contrast with that of behaving voluntarily. Thus, when the line between myself and what happens to me is dissolved, and there is no stronghold left for an ego even as a passive witness, I find myself not in a world, but as a world, which is neither compulsive nor capricious. What happens is neither automatic nor arbitrary. It just happens. and all happenings are mutually interdependent in a way that seems unbelievably harmonious. Every this goes with every that. Without others, there is no self, and without somewhere else, there is no here. So that, in this sense, self is other and here is there. When this new sensation of self arises, it is at once exhilarating and a little disconcerting. It is like the moment when you first got the knack of swimming or riding a bicycle. There is the feeling that you are not doing it yourself, but that it is somehow happening on its own, and you wonder whether you will lose it, as indeed you may if you try forcibly to hold on to it. In immediate contrast to the old feeling, there is indeed a certain passivity to the sensation, as if you were a leaf blown along by the wind, until you realize that you are both the leaf and the wind. The world outside your skin is just as much you as the world inside. They move together inseparably, and at first you feel a little out of control because the world outside is so much vaster than the world inside. Yet you soon discover that you are able to go ahead with ordinary activities, to work and make decisions as ever, though somehow this is less of a drag. Your body is no longer a corpse which the ego has to animate and lug around. There is a feeling of the ground holding you up, and of hills lifting you when you climb them. Air breathes itself in and out of your lungs, and instead of looking and listening, light and sound come to you on their own. Eyes see and ears hear as wind blows and water flows. All space becomes your mind. Time carries you along like a river, but never flows out of the present. The more it goes, the more it stays, and you no longer have to fight or kill it. You do not ask, what is the value or what is the use of this feeling? Of what use is the universe? What is the practical application of a million galaxies? Yet just because it has no use, it has a use, which may sound like a paradox, but is not. What, for instance, is the use of playing music? If you play to make money, to outdo some other artist, to be a person of culture, or to improve your mind, you are not really playing, for your mind is not on the music. You don't swing. When you come to think of it, playing or listening to music is a pure luxury, an addiction, a waste of valuable time and money for nothing more than making elaborate patterns of sound. Yet what would we think of a society which had no place for music, which did not allow for dancing, or for any activity not directly involved with the practical problems of survival? Obviously, such a society would be surviving to no purpose, unless it could somehow make a delight out of the essential tasks of farming, building, soldiering, manufacturing, or cooking. But in that moment, the goal of survival is forgotten. The tasks are being done for their own sake, whereupon farms begin to look like gardens. Sensible living boxes sprout interesting roofs and mysterious ornaments. Arms are engraved with curious patterns. Carpenters take time to finish their work, and cooks become gourmets. A Chinese philosophical work called The Secret of the Golden Flower says that when purpose has been used to achieve purposelessness, the thing has been grasped. For a society surviving to no purpose is one that makes no provision for purposeless behavior, that is, for actions not directly aimed at survival, which fulfill themselves in being done in the present and do not necessarily imply some future reward. But indirectly and unintentionally, such behavior is useful for survival because it gives a point to surviving, not, however, when pursued for that reason. To play so as to be relaxed and refreshed for work is not to play, and no work is well and finally done unless it, too, is a form of play. To be released from the you-must-survive double bind is to see that life is, at root, playing. The difficulty in understanding this is that the idea of play has two distinct meanings which are often confused. On the one hand, to do something only, or merely in play, is to be trivial and insincere, and here we should use the word toying instead of playing. But if some woman should say to